Senate Committee on Services to Seniors with Disabilities will come to order. Welcome. We're going to start today with a reconsideration. So I'll open a public hearing,
work session
on SJR 24.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on SCR 24.
Any objection?
Not from me.
Mr. Administrator.
Okay. Shall we get to it first before we do that?
Okay. Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which we pass SCR 24.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves we reconsider the vote by which we pass SCR 24. Discussion, seeing no discussion. Objection, seeing no objection. Would you call? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. We were, the work session for that bill is not properly noticed, so we will have to re-vote on it.
Okay, we're going to open the full discussion of whether or not there should be a Hood to Coast this year, or should we cancel it? Because the proponent of the bill is not here today, so we may just cancel the whole thing.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if we could have an amendment to require President Courtney to run only uphill roads.
Very good. Would you call the roll, please?
We need the motion, sir.
We have.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move SCR 24 be adopted.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves SCR be adopted. Go ahead. Excused.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. SCR 24, yeah. Senator Courtney will carry the bill. Okay, we're going to move to Senate Bill 1077. Senator Montes Anderson is here. Would you come up, please? And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1077.
Thank you, Chair Morissette and Vice Chair Cruz. Thank you for the opportunity to give this testimony. This is actually Senator Joanne Verger's testimony. She had a death in the family and was not able to be here, and therefore I am basically going to be reading her testimony for you. Low-income seniors are in an increasingly dire situation throughout our state. Oregonians on a fixed income are dealing with rising costs across the board, from property taxes to medical costs to food. Unfortunately, these increasing costs are forcing many seniors to choose which bills they can afford to pay. This decision-making process often leads to seniors doing without medication and other necessities. Senate Bill 1077 would provide great relief to low-income Oregon seniors struggling to make ends meet. Senate Bill 1077 provides an income tax credit of up to $300 to Oregon seniors over the age of 75 who earn less than $25,000 a year in household income. I will leave it to Mary Ayala from Legislative Revenue to explain the specific provisions. Senate Bill 1077 will provide needed assistance to low-income seniors who own their own homes. The state provides up to $2,100 to low-income seniors who rent through their Elderly Rental Assistance Program, yet there's little or no assistance for low-income seniors who wish to remain in their own homes. We need to help seniors live independently, not encourage them to vacate their family homes where they are most comfortable and will live longer. As we approach this session, it was made clear to all members how little money was available for allocation. This bill does have a minor fiscal impact. I want to underscore the importance of this fiscal impact. $300 can make the difference between filling a prescription regularly or doing without. It can be the difference between paying the electric bill and living without heat. It can literally be the difference between living with respect and dignity or living without. Based on the provisions of this bill, approximately 26,000 households could receive some portion of the maximum tax credit. And again, the maximum is $300. It seems so rare sometimes that we get to pass a measure with such a relatively small fiscal, which could have such amazing benefits for this vulnerable and deserving population. I urge you to support this bill and send a message to our low-income seniors that the state of Oregon cares about their welfare. And I have Mary Ayala to answer any specific questions regarding the bill.
The letter mentions fiscal impact, but we're talking revenue impact. Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Mary, would you...
Yes, thank you, Chair Morissette and Vice Chair Cruz. For the record, Mary Ayala, Legislative Revenue Office. And I did prepare the amendment, the revenue impact on what is actually Senate Bill 1077 as amended, the dash one amendment. That's what you're looking at. And that particular bill, if I can explain it quite simply, will give a qualified homestead property owner a possible maximum credit of $300 a year against his property, against his income taxes. In order to qualify, that person or the amount of the credit will be figured this way. It would be the amount of property tax paid in excess of 6.5% of his adjusted gross income, or it's the lesser of that, or $300, or the amount of income tax that is actually paid. Because there is no, this isn't a refundable tax credit. So in an example, if I had property taxes that were over 6.5% of my adjusted gross income, I could look at my the $300 as a possible maximum, or I could look at what my income tax liability was that year, and that the lesser of those things would be the amount that I would receive. Okay, and so basically, it's really doubtful that many of these people will get the full $300 if we're talking about the income group that we're talking about. Many of them have an effective income tax rate that's less than 5%. And so when we really figured out exactly how much each party, each person would, household would get, it probably won't be the maximum because 26,000 persons times the maximum is well over my impact statement, which is $1.2 million for the year. So maybe on the order of, and some people will not even benefit because they don't have taxes to pay. Then they'd be able to possibly carry forward their tax credit that's owed to them to the following year in the event at some point they do have a tax credit. And I think the carry forward provision in the bill is about 4 years. Okay? In conclusion, I would like to add that although the revenue impact is $1.2 million a year, the impact statements make some assumptions, and one of them is that there'll be really relatively little impact on the senior deferral program, because most people that are deferring their taxes, if they have a zero impact, they're not going to stop deferring because they wouldn't get the credit, right? And so most of the people or households that I've included in the analysis have not factored out those people that are on senior deferral. Finally, if there were people from the senior deferral program that switched from the program to taking a credit, it would be a wash because money's coming that's being paid out of general fund for senior deferral would be offset by the amount that they could claim as a credit. And so that's what I...
And, Mr. Chair, remember, you're dealing with the dash ones, not the original bill.
Yeah. Mary, the unused credits can be carried forward to subsequent years up to a $300 limitation. And then in the 09-11, it's $2.4 million cost. And is that expected to continue to accrue?
No. No, it's because the effective date of the... No, Mr. Chair. Sorry.
Okay.
It's a two-year rather than a one-year.
Okay. Thank you very much. Rick Bennett, are you... Oh, there you are. Okay.
Chair Morissette, Vice Chair Cruz, Committee Administrator Bracobian,
and
Staff Secretary,
Staff
Assistant, Committee Assistant.
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon, here testifying in support of Senate Bill 1077. I have not seen the Dash 1 amendments, but I don't think in general will change my comments. Okay, very good. Thank you, Senator Cruz. Just a few brief remarks related to the bill and property tax. The mainstay of local taxation is property tax. Property taxes fund vital services such as elementary and secondary education, police and fire protection, health services, and amenities such as parks and recreation facilities. The property tax is often considered a regressive tax for seniors, and it can be the single most burdensome tax for many low-income seniors. The tax does not take into account the ability to pay, except where circuit breaker programs are available. Rather, it is based on property values and property tax rates that may have escalated significantly over the decades that seniors have owned their homes. Therefore, various tax relief programs, such as homestead exemptions and credits, circuit breakers, and deferrals, are valid means for reducing the tax burden on people with limited or moderate income. As you're aware, we currently have a deferral program that works well for many people. But I should note that AARP's research shows that the program participants identified deferral programs as the least popular of the three types of relief programs, mainly because of the lien that's placed against the property. Obviously, property tax burdens are rising in much of the country, raising concerns about people being forced out of their homes because of an inability to pay their property taxes. Definitely, I appreciate this bill being brought forward. I testified last session on a similar bill and made mention of the fact that I had, just before that session, got a number of phone calls from our members. And I think it was kind of motivated by the fact they'd gotten their ballot measures and seen a number of measures that would impact their property rates. The comments that I received from them were that, in fact, they understood why those measures were being put forward. They wanted to support community services and so forth, but they were also becoming more and more concerned about their ability to pay their property taxes. And so, again, appreciate this bill being brought forward. We certainly support it. I think... I think we'd like different variables as far as age and income and the percentage that's being used and so forth, so more people would benefit, but I also understand the concerns related to the impact on revenue. So, again, please support this bill. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
One step at a time.
One step at a time. Thank you, Senator.
Others wishing to testify...
No.
Okay, would you come up and give your name, please?
My name is Jody Weiser. I'm a taxpayer.
The last name again?
Weiser. With Taxpayers Oregon. I don't support or oppose this bill, but in reading it over, it feels like the bill is redundant and that it would be available to such a small number of people, It would cost us money to set up the whole, what are the regulations going to be, that whole regulatory process. It would cost us to implement it each year because the Department of Revenue would have to check whether these taxpayers had paid property taxes, what the amount was, and then run through the various scenarios to figure out whether they got $20 or $75 or $300 worth of benefit. And because you would have to pay taxes at least once every 4 years to get any benefit, I think really very few people would get something. We would create a program, I'm afraid, that looks like we're giving something, but we're really not giving anything. And it would make better sense, perhaps, to use the energy and the funding that this is going to cost the state to advertise the fine deferral program that we have, which, you know, instead of giving a taxpayer a maximum of $300, we could give them a maximum of $3,000 in deferred taxes. They don't have to pay it. It'll get paid when they're dead, and they're not going to feel it at that point in time. And it would certainly provide much more money for them to buy groceries with at the time. That's my concern, is that we're starting another tax credit that doesn't accomplish enough to really help anybody significantly. We might be spending nearly as much managing the program as we're dispersing with the program. And it seems like people don't know about the deferral program, and we should be using our energy and time to advertise that instead. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a question, like, would that be a better use of our resources?
Well, I have inherently a problem with tax credits because currently we have tax expenditures that exceed the general fund by two times. I mean, we have twice as many tax expenditures, and that's the easy way mm-hmm. to do it, is a tax credit. It's easy. People love tax credits.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we have to judge, every time we take a look at removing a tax credit, we run into a whirlwind and so on, because each and every tax credit has those people who put it there and supporters and so on. It's very difficult to get rid of a tax credit. This is a relatively small tax credit, but we have many small ones which equal a lot of money. Now, the tax deferral program has a mixed reception. There are many people who, in principle, will not go that route simply because they want to hold on to their property for their heirs and so on. And I think it does work for some people. I don't know. I mean, it's
if we had the funds to give people a check for $1,000, it would make sense to give a tax credit for $1,000. We'd start getting to the place where it would do something significant for an individual or a family. But this is such a small amount of money that it seems like the overhead costs are going to be so high. And we're talking about a population whose ability to figure out the formula is probably more limited than the kids that are going to be paying the taxes instead. And I agree with you that people have a hard time with the concept of putting a lien on their house to pay their current property taxes, but I think that's a social issue we need to deal with. It's like, I mean, my own in-laws live in a house that they have $2 million worth of equity on, and they were talking about being cash poor. And I said, why don't you get a reverse mortgage? And they said, oh, well, we want to leave it all to the kids. And it's all, well, in that case, that's your decision, but let's help people make that decision that their own life is valuable and that they save that money for themselves, and they should use that money to support themselves. And getting your property taxes, not having to pay your property taxes at all, is worth probably $2,000 to $3,000 for most people who own a home, rather than $300. Mm-hmm. But we have to make it acceptable. We have to make it seem like a good idea so that people will embrace the idea instead of saying, oh, I don't like that idea. It just seems like that would be a better use of our state's limited resources.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Others wishing to comment? We do have the amendment.
Mm-hmm.
We want to go ahead and
let's do it.
Okay. We will go into work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1077.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1077. Discussion? Opposition? None. So moved. Mr. Chair, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1077 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be subsequently referred to the Committee on Finance and Revenue by prior reference.
And that's kind of a roundabout way. Senator Cruz moves that we refer the Senate Bill 1077 ultimately to the floor but through the bill on finance and through the Committee on Finance and Revenue. So we're going to send this bill to the Committee on Revenue if we pass this. Discussion? Further discussion?
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
I really like this bill, and I love tax credits. And if they're done right, and I think this one is done right, and I understand the problem with the deferral program. I truly do. Persons work their entire life to create something that's theirs and then to mortgage it back. It's just hard. And I don't think it's a matter of not understanding it. I think it's a matter of clearly understanding it. And so I think this isn't a panacea, but it's a step in the right direction. And my only regret, Mr. Chair, is that we aren't sending it directly to the floor. But with the help of the good folks here in this room, maybe that other committee can be convinced this is a good idea.
Well, my response is, as a tax and spend Democrat, I differ from my borrow and spend colleague.
Well said.
Well, with that, then we will. Would you call the roll, please? Excuse me.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, so the bill will be referred to Committee on Revenue and Finance. Okay, there we go. Subcommittee, gavel yourself in, please.
We'll give him a gavel.
Ooh, that's dangerous.
Thank you. I would like to open a informational hearing for the Subcommittee on Seniors and People with Disabilities, the Subcommittee of the Human Services, House Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee. There are too many words on this page. Sorry about that.
Where are you going?
I'm not going anywhere.
Good.
I'm just wondering where we're going next, Mr. Chair.
Where are we going next?
Thank you for allowing us to join you.
Okay.
And I might just explain real quick
explain
the
where
structure
we are,
of it here. The subcommittee, each Friday of the Seniors and People with Disabilities from the House will be joining the Senate Services and Seniors and People with Disabilities on just Fridays, I understand.
Hopefully.
And because there's a subcommittee that can't actually vote on bills, we do post this as an informational hearing, but we do kind of follow the same agenda as the Senate is following, just for clarity to the audience. So, thank you, Chair.
We're going to have copies made of this. That's what we're looking for. We're going to stand on each for just a moment. This is not the... Mr. Edge, would you come up, please? We're going to get copies of the proposed amendments. We don't have the amendment themselves, but you can speak to it.
Yes.
We're not going to move this bill today. We're going to move this bill on Tuesday.
When we have actual amendments.
Okay. Yeah. So go ahead and identify yourself.
Thank you, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Edge. I'm the administrator of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services. Just real briefly, I'll mention this is a bill that would speed up payments to rural health clinics, and specifically in cases where managed care plans make payments to rural health clinics, and then DHS, through a settlement process, makes an additional payment to those rural health clinics to pay up to the amount that we would pay normally through in our fee-for-service program. Currently, that process is somewhat of a lengthy one. We understand that these clinics are small clinics that sometimes operate on low profit margins, and they need their money, and understand the intent of the bill. We have proposed some amendments to the bill, which I guess you will see next week, and those amendments just clarify what we think we would need to speed up those payments. It clarifies exactly the information that we would need from the managed care plan, and also some information we would need from the rural health clinic, a report from each of them, to make sure that we're operating with the right information and paying them the right amount of money, specifically making sure that we know the exact amount that was paid and received, and also knowing if there are any third-party payments received. In some cases, another entity like Medicare may be making a payment on the same service. We wouldn't want to overpay and then put the clinic into a situation where it would owe us money back. So we feel we would need a report from both the managed care plans and from the rural health clinics in a timely manner, get that information, calculate the difference, and make the payment quickly if this bill is to work. There's a second part to the bill.
Excuse me.
Yes.
This is maybe the third time this, or the second time that I have worked this bill, and it's based on the premise that there be a period of reconciliation established that if the payment is over or under, that be reconciled at a particular time. It could be the next payment. And I understand if a clinic is overpaid, they might think that we were taking something back away from them if we took it back. But I think that's has to be, if this were to go into effect, that would have to be understood, that as a price for getting your payment in a timely manner, you might have to reconcile that at a later time. And to me, that is the key to this bill. And I know that we're never going to get, I don't think we will ever get all of the billing people together to be able to do a timely payment. And so I'm trying to create a mechanism by which we could get the payment and then reconcile it, either semi-annually or the next payment. So, and I know that there are some of the managed care organizations that don't like this. And so anyway, that's the premise of the bill, is to avoid what you just suggested had to be fixed before we could do it. It'll never be fixed.
Chair Morissette, you're right in that it will never be possible to pay them in a very short period of time the exact amount that's due. What this bill does is it builds on the payment made by the managed care plan. It then directs DHS within a short period of time to do what I would call an interim reconciliation. Okay. And then there would have to be a final reconciliation when all the information is available. And you're right, but by doing an interim payment, that could pay more or less than the actual amount that's going to be paid in the final reconciliation. It could create a situation where the rural health clinic might owe money back to DHS rather than DHS owing money to the rural health clinic. But it's an attempt to get them what's owed to them a little faster than they're getting it today, and understand the desire on their part to do that. The second part of this bill includes a different topic, and that's the sharing of protected health information. There's a section 2 of the bill that talks about sharing protected health information. That is similar or actually probably the same as a bill that was introduced during the last session that talked about sharing protected health information between managed care plans, physical managed care plans, and mental health managed care plans. During last session, that raised some concerns about the client's role in the sharing of that information. It became somewhat controversial about whether that information should be shared in that way and how much role the client should have in approving or not approving whether that information gets shared. I would suggest that we may be getting into a controversial area to stick that in this bill. It's a different topic than the speeding up the payments. And our suggestion would be not to include Section 2 in this bill, but that would be your choice. The third issue I would just raise is that by speeding up the payments, it creates a one-time cost to DHS and a little bit of additional ongoing administrative cost. The one-time cost is the big cost, and you'll see in the fiscal analysis that there's a $579,000 fiscal impact in this biennium for this bill for the speeding up of the payments.
Now, will that diminish as time goes on?
Senator Morissette, yes. That's primarily a one-time cost from the speeding up of the payments,
okay,
and then after that it would just be the additional administrative cost of doing both an interim payment and a final reconciliation, which would be much less than that in future biennium.
Questions? Okay, good. Thank you, Jim. Thank you very much. Scott Ekblad and Ed Patterson, would you come up?
We've got Troy.
Oh, Troy. Troy. Yeah, all three of you come up, please. Troy.
You can join me for a comment.
Okay.
Now or...
I'm going to hear it there.
Yeah, okay. Any time you want to jump in, feel free.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1065. I think that Mr. Edge did a great job of explaining basically what this bill does. I don't see any need to repeat that. We are more than happy to work with DMAP to make sure that whatever is proposed in the amendments works for us and doesn't create any undue burden for DMAP. That certainly isn't the goal. Mm-hmm. So we're happy to do that. As for the language that's in the section, second section of the bill, we were a bit surprised to see that too when it came back. When we inquired about it, we were told that Legislative Council felt it was necessary in order to exchange the information to get the bills paid quickly. But if that is not in fact required, we're perfectly fine with taking that out of the bill.
I would agree.
All right. I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Mr. Patterson.
Senator Morissette, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm here today representing the Oregon Rural Health Association. I'm the executive director for that group, which is a voluntary group, consists of about 750 individual members who pay dues, and about 100 organizations. Part of those organizations is a subsection that we created a couple of years ago of rural health clinics, because they are so diversified, they're spread all over the state. They're very small, some only operate with one or two people, and they're mostly all very marginal financially, most of them are. And there's been a number of steps taken to assist those hospital or those rural health clinics to get something closer to their cost of providing the service to the clients. And this is when the feds, about 4 or 5 years ago, started paying them cost-based reimbursement. But subsequent to that, more and more managed care has crept into the provider as providers of care in the rural parts of the state, and that's where the Medicaid managed care programs have really impacted financially the cash flow of a lot of these rural health clinics. A lot of these are very marginal operations. Some are subsidized through property taxes. They create a health district in a rural area and are subsidized through local health property taxes. But as part of our board meeting last month, we have two representatives of rural health clinics on our board. We have a 17-member board, and we knew that Senator Morissette was going to introduce this bill, so we had a big discussion about that. And because they are so marginal operations cash flow-wise, some of the clinics are waiting 6 to 8 months to get their full basis for providing services, mm-hmm. even though that providing of the money most of the time doesn't cover their cost. But some of the other patient loads they have do help cover their costs. So we support this bill 100%. Obviously, it's going to take a little tinkering, but the success of these 54 clinics spread around the state is very much dependent on solving the cash flow that some of them have. We've got three or four now that are considering closing the doors because they're not viable financially. So we would hope that the differences with DMAP can be worked out, and that the bill will come out of this committee and go to Ways and Means. Ways and Means will recognize that, yes, there is some one-time costs, but like most projects, rural health projects, the cost is very small to the state by comparison to the benefits that are received downstream to the providers. So we think this is a good bill, and it's obvious after our board discussion that it's very much needed to solve the cash flow problems in the rural parts of the state. Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Cruz.
For either of you, I'm just looking, you don't have them, but the proposed amendments from the department. And just, and then, you know, it says that rural health clinic must report payments from a prepaid managed care health services organization, and it's going to be by administrative rule. My question is, why shouldn't we have the managed care organization do the report? They have the administrative capability to do that, where a lot of these clinics are one-person operations, and that's taking away from doing the actual services to do the reports. Is there any way we could flip that?
Well, Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, that was one of the things that we thought would actually help remedy the situation, is rather than the clinic waiting to find out what the payment was going to be from the managed care organization and then reporting it to DMAP so that DMAP could make them whole with the supplemental payment, that the managed care organizations could simply inform both at the same time and shave some time off the whole process. So, as you said, I have not seen a copy of the amendment, so I can't
really
comment.
Mr. Chair, that's just one thing that kind of stuck out at me, that we're looking at some very single operator operations, and we're requiring more reports from them when the MHOs have got to make the reports anyway. So,
Representative Maurer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will chime in on that. For those of you that don't know, I own a rural health clinic, one of the rural health clinics in Jackson County in Rogue River, and I am the one that personally does this report. I'm the one that waits 8 months to get payment.
8 months.
In fact, January 31st was my due date for the quarter March, April, May of 07, which means that I, as a, well, it's actually my wife, as a sole practitioner, has to wait a substantial length of time before I get payment, full payment. And I don't get interest. I'm looking at you, Ed, but, you know. I don't get interest. But I will have to say that this system is better than the federal government, where I have to wait up to 2 years to get payment for giving someone a flu shot. And I have to carry the cost up front. And it's called the Medicare Cost Report. That's why our clinics stopped getting flu shots. to the local citizens, because we cannot carry, you know, $10,000 for a substantial length of time. It just doesn't make any sense. And our clinic, I think financially, is solvent. And these clinics, particularly on the coast and east of the mountains, those are the ones that are really, quite frankly, are not doing very well. So besides supporting the bill, and, you know, I declare my conflict now, real conflict, but I about the dual reporting, I'm having to do the report today anyway. So this is not a new report. And so, and again, I would agree with Mr. Ekblad that I don't want to create a new system now where it's out of my hands to report information that I have available, waiting for a managed care organization to do something, and the state then saying, no, we can't do it because we don't have the information, when, by golly, I've got it today. And I will have to give credit to the managed care organizations that they are much better today than they were a couple years ago, and how they pay and how they deal with it. And that is an evolving process, and it's evolving to the better as opposed to the worse. So I don't want to throw a wrench into a system that is going to cause a problem, because I do have the information today that I could submit. As long as I submit my claim timely, in a timely manner, those managed care organizations provide us a payment, a reimbursement, in a timely manner, and I have the correct information. And so I guess I am relatively comfortable with that line.
Now, your clinic, as I remember from past discussion in the committee, was brought up to date in terms of your electronic system even before you purchased it. Is that correct?
Yeah, the clinic has electronic medical records and has had it since 1997.
Okay. Now, what about clinics that do not have that?
The medical records are a completely separate issue. Most clinics do have electronic billing system, practice management systems, although some, I suppose, do not. And it's difficult to speak to that issue.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is this is not necessarily a time sufficient problem for the clinics, even though they are able to get their information in on time, they still don't get the payment, right?
That's
there's
correct.
Still the delay. So it isn't, you can't necessarily go back and say, well, if the clinics only had the computers, if they only had all of this stuff, they would be getting their money on time.
No.
That's not.
No,
that's
absolutely. And the comment to the fiscal to this, you know, the $500,000+, it's not the state's money. I mean, the state's holding it. They're collecting interest on it, but it's not the state's money. It's the clinic. The provider, they provided the service. So the state's carrying afloat. And you know, if they're willing to give us the interest, then, you know, a good interest rate, we'll be sure to do a promissory note and they can pay us. But that's not the way it works.
Well, I think that's a good point that you're making. When we send this bill to Ways and Means, we would like to send a note along with it saying that's money.
You know, it's not. I mean, the state is holding money that is an obligation that they have anyway.
That's an interesting perspective. Okay, thank you. Would you like to comment, please?
Chair Morissette, fellow committee members, I'd just like to echo.
Sure, I'll introduce yourself.
Troy Sonnen, Oregon Office of Rural Health. Essentially, I'm one of the folks at our office that spends at least 60% of my time in rural areas working with our rural health clinics. And essentially, as you said, Senator Cruz, there is sort of a, you know, the clinics, they bill the managed care organization, and then there's a waiting period that's in the contract with the state and the managed care organization on when that data is returned back to the clinic. And then essentially for the clinics that don't have, computer systems to pull out the information that they're going to have to bill for the wraparound, some of our clinics have to actually manually go through all of those claims and then, add it up to see which ones they're going to get the wraparound payment on. So for a clinic, for example, in Nisa, Oregon, where they were operating under a set budget and then had their population entered into a managed care plan, are now currently not able to pay their monthly bills because their budget has been changed from getting money from month to month now on a delayed payment system. So that's why it's really significant that for our isolated facilities that this goes through.
Tell me about the Elgin and Union Clinic.
The Elgin and Union Clinic are currently being operated by Oregon Health and Science University and are currently undergoing a process of looking at being run independently or looking at becoming community-based clinics. OHSU is not going to be running those clinics anymore. So what we're looking at is trying to set up in one particular community, Elgin, a health district where folks actually tax themselves to keep health care locally. And both of those clinics do have managed care populations and do depend on getting timely payment for supplemental payment for Medicaid folks.
We heard a bill earlier today in another committee dealing with telemedicine, and Senator Atkinson, I thought, made a very eloquent plea toward the end of that hearing because there was some consideration of whether or not that bill was going to move about the state of health care in rural Oregon, exacerbated by the fact that the feds are maybe cutting back medical expenses as well as the county timber receipts diminishing, and that would be across the board cuts in for counties to make, which could impact the clinics as well. And so I think that we have to pay particular concern, and we need to do something about the rural health and the clinic level. That's the bottom line right there, is the health care delivery in rural Oregon. Much of it depends on the clinic. And if the clinics go away, then there will be small communities that are going to be in really bad shape. So,
and I'll just to add to that, in the discussion of the 329 process, the health reform, we're not talking about major dollars here, but we are talking about access to populations that otherwise have no preventive care, no primary care, and we're talking such an absolute minimal investment in dollars. And whatever population you want to talk about, whether it's seniors, disabled folks, whether it's children, whether it's the working poor, and these clinics have a role, and if we are going to restructure health care, health reform, I think there's a lot to be learned by how these clinics operate, on a shoestring, and the good that they do for communities, because, you lose clinics in Elgin and Union, and I'm not, quite frankly, I wouldn't say OHSU is probably the best management for the Elgin and Union Clinic, because you need people that are there, that are involved locally, to actually, be the owners and run this place. And you lose that, and I would almost guarantee that you're going to lose people in that community if they're just say, I can't stay here anymore. I've got to move because I have health concerns. And that primarily is the senior population. It's not the children go where their parents are, but the senior population in a lot of cases do have choices and they would move. And I don't think that's the best thing for Oregon as a whole.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Go ahead. Senator Cowan. Representative.
Thank you. That was easy. I was trying very hard to keep my mouth shut, but I can't do it. I just want to say thank you to the good chair and the Senate committee, who's not listening to me, that for bringing this bill forward and doing whatever you can for rural communities and rural clinics. And thank you so much for mentioning Elgin and Union Clinics. I actually built that, was a significant part of the early stages of the Elgin Clinic, and the first time it closed and what we did to bring it back again, and then the structure that it's in now. And I was heartbroken when I heard that there were difficulties there. But it's such a credit to the communities, and that's what I wanted to follow up on Representative Maurer's comments, that they're willing to step up to the plate and try to develop a local health district and, as was said, tax themselves, because that's how important a rural clinic is in these communities. While I worked at the Elgin Medical Center, not only did we treat the individuals that came by, but I've also treated a horse and a dog that dropped by, because they were desperately in need of some emergency care before they could get them to the veterinarians that they were headed for. These are rural areas, and people have already traveled a significant distance by the time they get to the clinic, let alone till they get to the next big city. So I can't begin to express my level of passion for the importance of small rural clinics, and I just want to thank you for the effort here.
Well, I think there are a number of us have been involved in the rural health care. Representative Maurer was involved in this original discussion when we were over at the health convention, and we talked about it, and certainly Senator Cruz has been involved with this longer than I have, so, and that's a long time. I mean, that is really long.
Well,
that is really long. we did take, and Ed Patterson was with us, and we took a 4-day trip, I think it was in the 01 or 03 session. We visited 14 different facilities in 3 or 4 days, and we involved clinics, hospitals, nursing homes.
And Elgin was one of them.
Elgin was one of them. And
Granite.
We heard from doctors, we heard from healthcare professionals, EMTs, and that made a very, very lasting impression, as far as I'm concerned, because it's a very fragile network, and it's an economic development issue, because if we want to reconnect Oregon, we have to develop both healthcare and education, because companies will not move to a place where there's not adequate healthcare. That's a given, and so it's important that we establish that as an economic base. And so this is extremely important for us to do.
Mr. Chairman, may I make just one comment?
Would you re-identify yourself?
Ed Patterson.
Okay.
Oregon Rural Health Association. I want to make my comments aim primarily at Representative Cowan, because our new president of our association is Dr. Lisa Dodson, who is in charge of the AHEC program in the state. Mm-hmm. And in order to keep the Elgin Clinic open, she's going over there 2 days a week herself and taking care of patients, because they have to maintain the federal resident definition as a rural health clinic. So that's the kind of commitment which you see would come from our group, and we feel strongly about it, just like you do.
Road trip time again. Bill.
Yeah, road trip. Right.
Can I go, please?
Yes.
if
we want to visit a rural clinic, we can just go to Newport. That's about as rural as you can get.
Well, it doesn't take quite as long to get there, but we do have a federally qualified health center as well as a rural health center.
Okay. Good. Okay. Thank you. We will. Oh, thank you for being here. Any others wishing to testify on this particular issue? If not, we will close the public hearing, and we will come back on Tuesday with.
Okay.
We may drop part of the bill, and we may have an amendment for another part of the bill. Whether or not we adopt that amendment, we will discuss at the time. So we now will move to Senate Bill 1061. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1061. Nobody wants to testify. Barry, would you come up, please? excuse me, Jim. Would you, James? Would you please come up? I'm sorry, James. Yeah, go ahead and jump just a minute. And let me just say a few words. We're not going to move this bill today for a couple of reasons. We are getting completely mixed messages from the co-chairs and others on the Ways and Means Committee as to whether or not we should keep Section 1 in, including your co-chair, who I talked to yesterday. We have had a revenue forecast, which does not bode well for this bill going to Ways and Means as a bill. Whether or not, now, let me rephrase this a little bit. The revenue forecast is not as much as the rainy day reserve fund that we have, for one thing. We do have a closing balance, for another. We do have a rebalance that is really what we're looking at in terms of funding the part of the bill that we think is the most important. Well, it is the most pressing problem right now that we've identified. So we're going to listen. I will be consulting, and we will be consulting with not only DHS, we will be talking to Ways and Means people to see if what the best option is. We want to preserve sections 2 and 3 of the bill because that is, you know, that's an equally important part for what we want to establish. If the bill does go to Ways and Means and we can have assurances that it will then be referred out to both houses, then I'm happy to move the bill to Ways and Means to come back to both houses. I'm getting authoritative advice from some people, don't do it because you're never going to see the light, it won't come back. And others are saying, well, we should do it. So we're going to postpone that decision until Tuesday, which is the day we have to make the final decision. So, Mr. Taves, do you have...
Mr. Chairman and Madam Chair, on Section 1, just in terms of what the department has done, we took what was in our rebalance plan, the $9.7 million figure for the rate increase for the senior and disability community programs, and transposed it into a fiscal impact statement for this bill with Section 1 still included, so that when Ways and Means decided whether it needed to come there or not come there, they had it both in the rebalance plan and in a fiscal impact statement attached to this bill. And I think we copied both of you as chairs on that. So we're ready to go either way. It's still part of our rebalance at this point, and I think whether it's in the bill or not in the bill, we're going to continue to articulate the issue as a major caseload issue that really is cost avoidance to avoid the nursing home caseload and the huge costs that go with that. So either way, we will work with you and are very comfortable on whatever decision is made. So we have both a fiscal impact statement and the issue in our rebalance plan. On Section 2 and 3, and I don't think I'll go through the sections again. We've spent a lot of time on that. You did request at the last meeting that we kind of lay out our time frames. And so I wanted to go on the record here indicating what we're proposing in terms of time frames. Section 2, as it now stands, which is really the long-range plan portion of the bill, again, by prior budget note, is due July 1st. So backing up from there, what we anticipate is we will have a first draft based on a lot of research and different work groups that are going on now done by the beginning of April or by mid-April at the latest. It'll still be a draft. It'll have parts of it that are works in progress, but nonetheless, we anticipate between mid-April and mid-May we would do a whole bunch of stakeholder input sessions so that all of our stakeholders interested in different sections of that plan will have lots of time to review ideas, push back, make additional recommendations, which we will then take and redraft the plan. Our goal is still to do public forums statewide in June, with what will emerge as pretty close to a final draft, and then get ready for the July report. So that's kind of the time frame on Section 2 of the long-range plan. On Section 3...
Excuse me. What form will the statewide forums take? Are you talking about the Governor's Commission on Seniors?
Mr. Chairman, we are scheduling a meeting in early March with all our stakeholder groups to discuss how we host those. Last time they were hosted primarily by the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. I think there's other stakeholder groups, labor, the AAAs, the physical disability advocacy groups that I think all have a vital stake in this. So we're going to have the conversation with them well in advance and get their input on how those should be structured. So we're hoping by the time we bring you something in July, it's had lots of comment, and I won't venture a guess on consensus, but nonetheless, it will have hopefully a lot of support behind it and a lot of input. On Section 3, which are the additional items that many of the stakeholders and people on this committee are interested in that the department look at, include cost projections, potentially include in the long-range plan, but recognizing some of it may not, or may not even appear in the governor's recommended budget, but nonetheless, you wanted the data, the information, and the cost projections. Those we will, all the items in Section 3, we'll commit to having those done by no later than September 1st. What we'll do in the next several months is, and we have cost projections on parts of that already based on previous requests, we'll meet with consumer or stakeholder groups that are interested in each of those areas to get their cost assumptions that they want to share with us. We'll do the fiscal work on that. We'll then meet for a second or a third time with those folks to share those cost projections again well in advance of issuing them in a final report. And then we'll make those available again by the beginning of September, which is before or about at the time when the governor's when we release our proposed budget to the governor for his consideration as well. So I hope, and I can follow up with a memorandum that kind of outlines that, but I know a lot of stakeholders know so much is going on and are concerned that some groups could get left out of this process because it's going to have to move very, very fast. But that's our commitment, and we'll reduce that to writing for you as well.
Okay. Now, yesterday I spoke with both co-chairs. One of them asked me to give him a copy of the bill that I marked up a bit. He was interested in Section 2 and 3. That tells you which co-chair. He
yeah,
was
you interested. Gave it away.
I gave it
a couple of minutes ago.
And what I was trying to do is get some assurance that, you know, it was just Section 1 that had the fiscal. And so I guess my question to you is that you did not submit any additional resources, or I mean, when you are required to report a fiscal, you tell them what it's going to cost. Now, you're going to absorb. You can do Section 2 and 3 within your department. Is my question.
You mean the extra 100 staff that we? No, no.
That's what I'm talking about. Exactly.
No, Mr. Chairman, many of our staff and our stakeholder groups have been working on this already because it's part of it. Because, again, what this bill really does is pull together and codify a lot of things that have been in the works that have come from various different directions, both from you and from other stakeholders as well. So, no, we're Sections 2 and 3, from the department's perspective, will not have any additional fiscal impact.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
So it's part of your existing work plan to move this direction anyway.
Madam Chair, correct.
Thank you. And I appreciate the general timelines that you've provided. A couple of points that I'd like to make as far as inclusion in the process and the importance of it.
I think it's important for folks to remember that the items in Section 3 were not intended to be exclusive. They were intended to be inclusive. They were part of an initial group of folks coming together and sort of brainstorming all of the things that we need to look at in the long-term care system, and we requested of the department that we get some assistance with getting an idea of what these various things will cost as we move forward. But you mentioned that all of the items in Section 3 may or may not be in the long-range plan that you're doing, and I want to emphasize that that's totally appropriate because we don't expect to be able to accomplish everything that's listed in this bill in one fell swoop, and certainly not in one session. So not everything is going to move into 09, but we do want to put together a good look at what our long-term care system for this population looks like on the whole, and then be able to do responsible planning as we move forward in future years. And so I just wanted to sort of highlight that note and kind of reassure folks that this is a step-by-step process. We intend to get the information, and then we have hopes of moving it as we can and as revenues allow.
Yes, Representative Gelsinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this was a question for my Senate colleagues. When we had our last meeting together before introducing the bill, we had talked about some minor language amendments to the bill that would make it clear that this was for the senior and physical disabilities portion of SPD and not the developmental disabilities portion. Are those amendments forthcoming?
We do have an amendment from Mr. Towers that we're adding to the bill. Is that what you're talking about?
No, I was talking about, they were little things. We had talked about, for example, on page 1, line 21, it was lots of housing options for seniors and persons with severe disabilities, which would imply that it was encompassing, you know, the whole universe of people with disabilities, replacing severe with physical. And then we had also talked about, in some of those places around Section 2, rather than speaking generally about services to persons with disabilities and least restrictive long-term care and access to senior companion and mental health, drug addiction treatment, that we were going to clarify that was physical disabilities.
Okay. To the best of our record, go ahead.
I'll tell you, first off, Section 1, the whereases don't end up in statute anyway, so.
Okay.
I mean, the whereases or a preamble, they don't end up in that actual ORS.
In ORS.
So.
Okay, thank you for that. But what I was going to say also is that we're going to move this bill on Tuesday. There is some additional tweaking. We have not yet integrated the amendment that was proposed by Art Towers. That's going to be in there. We did have a draft, a different amendment draft, different language for Section 1. If we decide to include Section 1, that other language, it would have been nice to move the bill today, but there are a number of factors, including the revenue forecast, that we have to look at. Now, this then gives you time. We've talked about some of these things. Apparently, we did not write them down. Would you please get what you would like to see added to this bill? And if we can possibly do that by Tuesday, we will.
Sure, I'm happy. I don't think I have the authority to request an amendment.
No. So. Get them to me.
Okay.
And to
okay.
Mr. Kovian, and we will make sure that they are drafted and can, if they are congruent with what we're doing, which I'm sure they are, we can include them.
I think I have a former marker.
Well,
you can get them to me, and we can have them drafted.
Work with it and work for
I would suggest
any bill in any committee.
Okay.
Would you call my husband
and
my children and share that information with them?
as soon as you hit State Street, it all stops.
What I would suggest is that you work with our committee administrator, Rick McCovey. Work with Rick. Yeah.
I'd like to follow up some comments on the Section 1, but would you like to take...
Yes, I want to bring in our guru... Well, let me just say that I've been mentioning this to various people, including our president, who Senator Courtney, who is ill, by the way. He left not feeling well today. I don't know if it had anything to do with the weather revenue forecast, but he is not here. It looks like the revenue forecast is down somewhat, and I think that would bode ill for a lot of the things that we're attempting to do. But what I've been saying is that this is a time, then, this is the perfect time for the rest of our bill. And so I'd like Barry to talk about that.
Sure.
And talk about some of the things that we would like to do as a committee.
Sure.
To get us through the hard times and prepare for the good times. So, Barry, would you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. Chair Morissette, Chair Cowan, I'm Barry Donenfeld. I'm the president of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, and I'm also the executive director of Northwest Senior and Disability Services, which is the area agency on aging that serves Marion, Polk, Yamhill, Clatsop, and Tillamook counties. And on behalf of all of that, I'm here to strongly support the bill today. I think that it's important that we note the leadership of Senator Morissette and Representative Cowan on bringing issues like this out into the open to be discussed, to be researched, to have the stakeholders chew them over, and to come up with a plan. That leadership has been lacking for quite a while. In the legislative sense, these issues did not get their full hearing in the last session, and it was very troubling to most of us who know that the demographics that are before us, which were highlighted, by the way, in this morning's revenue forecast, there's a demographic portion to the revenue forecast. The demographic portion of the revenue forecast this morning clearly stated that the fastest growing part of Oregon's population will be elderly people. That starting in 2012, with a general population growth of 1.4%, the growth in the elderly population will be 5%, almost four times higher. That's an astonishing demographic rate. And it leads us to know that if we don't change something about the way we're doing business now, which is to rely totally on Medicaid, which we've now cut all of the preventive long-term care services out of, the long-term care needs of that population and the population of adults with physical disabilities, which while we can't pinpoint that kind of growth, it's reasonable to assume that given medical and pharmaceutical advances, individuals that fit into that category are going to far exceed the projections we might have had a few years ago for their anticipated lifespans. It's also interesting to note that the demographic portion of today's revenue forecast projects virtually zero growth in the 5 to 24 age cohort and the 45 to 64 age cohort. So almost all of Oregon's growth is going to occur in the senior population. And if we don't fix the crumbling system that we have and develop the kind of resources that this bill speaks to in sections 2 and 3, the caseloads that are required under federal Medicaid law, the increases in those caseloads, which we've already begun to see, are literally going to eat the budget. And we have, like that old commercial from years and years ago, have ourselves in the position of, you can pay me now, or you can pay me later. And that was about a low-cost oil filter for a car as opposed to an engine overhaul. But I think the principle still holds in today's times. We have the ability to serve people through programs that have demonstrated the ability to avoid costs over long periods of time that we have not supported appropriately, programs like Oregon Project Independence, and we have the ability to grow those programs and avoid many of the higher costs that will come from not having lower cost preventive services available when we can get to people at the start of their decline into their needs for long-term care, as opposed into the middle of their decline or later than that, when they become significantly more challenging cases and more expensive cases. We all have appreciated working with you and Representative Cowan in a more informal sense and the variety of meetings and work sessions that we've held during the interim so that we can actually talk through these issues. I think the items in the bill speak for themselves in terms of the consensus that was achieved by major stakeholder groups getting together and identifying those things that we need to work on. I think that it should be noted that for many, many years, and still probably today if you look comparatively to other states, the Medicaid system in this state still looks very, very good in comparison to other states. It's only those of us that are here in the state that realize how crumbling the foundation of that system actually is. But in our case mix, we still serve the highest proportion of people in the country in home and community-based care than any other state. That isn't necessarily going to continue forever. But one of the things that most people don't realize is that this state has never made the investments in other kinds of long-term care that have been made in many other states. In this state, if you can't get into Medicaid, there's virtually nothing to assist you with long-term care needs. I think the items that have been highlighted in Section 2 and 3 of this bill put us on the road to beginning to develop those non-Medicaid alternatives through concepts like I know the one that Chair Morissette has been speaking about that's called the New Front Door, which is based on very tested and proved principles that have occurred in other states and at the federal level through a new type of entity called an Aging and Disability Resource Center that has probably been most fully developed in the state of Wisconsin, and we have been borrowing from their experience to try and more fully create that concept here in the state of Oregon. It will require investments. It will require creating something that doesn't yet exist. But if we do that, we can pretty much understand that we will avoid significant costs in the future because that's what's happened in the other states that have gone down that road. Because that becomes a huge diversion program where you divert individuals who would otherwise go into higher cost settings to both spend their own resources more wisely than they would otherwise spend them, to utilize products like long-term care insurance they might not have otherwise known about or purchase, to plan their retirements in a much better way than they might have without taking into account the significant costs that long-term care can bring to someone's retirement. It's still an unbelievable myth in this country that Medicare covers long-term care. And Medicare does not cover long-term care, and there are too many people who labor under the delusion that when they get to the age where they're going to need long-term care, it's all going to be covered by their Medicare. And that's simply not true. You heard earlier the resistance that people have to working their entire lifetime to pay off a home and then have to sign that home over to the state to get the kind of help that they desperately need. There are better ways to do these things, and I think this bill points us in that direction. And again, I thank you for your leadership.
Thank you very much, and I would say that the Department of Human Services, particularly the senior division, has been working with us all the time, constantly. 99% of our meetings are with you guys. You're there, and we're working together on this, and so I'm... You know, that should dispel the need, if there is any belief that we need more money to do this. I mean, you're providing a lot of the information along with the department that we're gathering. So,
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Could I just add my thanks to the department, too? I know that having us here in Salem creates a tremendous workload for you, and you've all been very responsive this week on a whole lot of issues. So thank you very much to the department for working so closely with us so quickly.
We had a better fiscal revenue forecast. I'd recommend a raise for you, Mr. Chase, or in your department.
Probably already has one scheduled.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we'll see about
I can
that.
See all the heads behind you.
I will not relate what I'm seeing from here.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
yes.
Medicare does offer long-term care as long as it's only 20 days.
Yeah.
So. Short long-term care.
Yeah. Very good.
I'd like to keep Mr. Chaves at the table here and make a comment if I could. So, earlier this morning in another committee, I made some brilliant notes that I can't find anymore, unfortunately. Probably put them in the wrong file, but the comments were around frustration that we're always reactive instead of proactive, and we wait until some huge crisis blows up in our face and then we try to figure out what to do about it. We've known the trends for a long time, and the folks that are in this room have been pointing them out to us, but the good news is that we aren't yet at crisis. And personally, I think the demographic trends to longer life are really good. But but on a big picture, I understand what's going to happen. So for me, the good news of this bill is that we are actually taking a proactive approach, that we're looking at what we know things are going to cost us, and we're trying to do something about it. So although everybody is a little frustrated over the disturbing forecast that we got today, I want to reassure people a little bit that I don't see it as disastrous for this bill. And we've debated the pros and cons of Section 1, and to get a little more specific about that, the question that we're all struggling with in our mind is whether the piece that actually accomplishes an increase in rates for our current mid-level providers, our assisted livings, adult foster care, residential care, that sort of thing, for seniors and people with physical disabilities, because there is a cost to raising rates, whether we should leave that in the bill right now or whether we should move it out. But what I want to reinforce is that taking Section 1 out of the bill does not mean that the rate increase will not happen.
That's right.
And it's important that we understand that the department has stepped up early in this conversation and said we agree that this is what we have to do to forestall what will be significant costs to the state of Oregon and to our budget if we continue to lose access in those lower cost facilities, and we make it necessary for people to be inappropriately placed in a higher level of nursing home care at a much higher cost. I do believe that the Ways and Means Committee understands that and understands that the rate increase that's built into the department's rebalance plan, in other words, spends some of the additional federal funds that we're happy to have, and I don't want to get technical about it, that the way to do that is to put it into a modest rate increase for those facilities and to open up more access to people to the appropriate level of care at a lesser cost. And I think that will stay in the rebalance plan. And so we're pretty comfortable. I want people to understand that whether Section 1 is in or out of this bill, it doesn't mean that we aren't moving forward with this discussion at the Ways and Means level, and we're still confident that will happen. I really do believe that because so many people in this room have come together and talked about this and made this message clear, that we have a strong message to take forward, and then we can do the necessary planning for the next steps. So I really feel like it's necessary to provide a little reassurance that as we
talk about the amendments and the pluses and the minuses and how should we handle it. It's kind of internal. I still believe that at the end of this session, we will come out with a package that accomplishes the rate increase that we're, at least some level of rate increase that we're looking at, will improve, will open up more access in those facilities. The industry has been right there talking to us and are being very generous in their conversations, and that we will build on into some long-term planning that we need to do. So this committee is going to be the decider on how the bill is packaged, but the message will remain the same, and I'm not going to stand in the way of however you feel you want to package it.
Well, it was inopportune in some ways that the, you know, we were going to move the bill today, and yet the revenue forecast came down, and it makes it difficult to understand which way to go, but we will know by Tuesday.
Mr. Chair, in all due respect, we know now, in my opinion. I mean, when we started this process, we were looking at increasing rates to general fund. That's the way the bill reads. And the bill says, Section 1 says nothing about the rebalance. And the rebalance has nothing to do with the revenue forecast. Nothing whatsoever. The rebalance is the rebalance. And the department's going to do this because it's the smart, wise thing to do. Because if they don't do it, they're going to incur significant increases other places. So, you know, I mean, it's fortunate that we have the rebalance, and that's where we've landed, because if we were relying on general fund to do this, we weren't going to get it.
Well,
fair and simple.
Yeah,
so,
except that the piece of paper that I saw from issued by your agency to fiscal, that $9.7 million is listed as general fund money. That is general fund money. That's the way it was lined out. It did not, the word rebalance was not used in that. So I guess the assumption is that any money that is taken from the rebalance is general, that is general fund money to be used whatever, you know, for whatever. Now, if the word rebalance was used in there, I would feel better about it, but it's a general fund. My concern is that, you know, if the Ways and Means Committee thinks that things are going not to get better, every single bit of available general fund money might be put in the closing.
Chair, the rebalance does not revert money to the general fund.
Well, that's the you look at the paper that was issued by the agency, and it does not say rebalance.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I understand what you're saying. Essentially, everything that we do and have discretion over is general fund money in a sense, processed a little differently. You could go into work session, pass your DAS 1 amendments, and pass this out without Section 1, and it would be fine.
We'll do that Tuesday.
Yeah, Tuesday we will.
I want you to get it out of here and get it over to my side.
Do it.
I want you to go to your side.
We're going to build the drama a little bit. So.
But the semantic use of the language, whether we're talking rebalance general fund, I mean, that's a semantic. I mean, the money is there. It can be used however the Ways and Means people want to use it. And if they want to put it in the general fund and save it, they can. The smart thing to do is to put it into rate increase, because we're going to pay that money anyway. As people move to nursing homes, it will have to be taken out of some money from somewhere in your department. So it's a no-brainer to use that money, the rebalance money for the rates. So, okay, other comments? Okay, so with that, yes, we will carry this over till Tuesday. We're going to carry over Senate Bill 1065, Senate Bill 1061. What about the other one?
Do you want to the schedule possible reconsideration of SCR 24, just to kind of tweak Peter a little bit, or just let it go?
Well, we'll consider possible reconsideration of SCR 24.
Mr. Chair,
Oh, I'm sorry.
Never mind. I haven't closed my side.
No, we're you're still open.
Oh, you're still open.
Representative Maurer.
Thank you, Andrew. Senator Morissette.
Yes.
We had a conversation outside about Senate Bill 1065, and then I'm going to work with the department and the managed care organizations because we believe that there may not be a need for the managed care organizations to provide the information they're being asked to provide.
Oh.
Thus, streamlining the both the legislative effort and the payment effort. So that these clinics can get reimbursed sooner. But we still have some issues to work out, and we will meet Monday. And I will definitely keep you in the loop on what's going on.
Okay. Okay. And then we will be back on Tuesday.
Absolutely.
With that bill. Good. Well, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, thank you for allowing us to sit in with you in a joint session. It's unfortunate that we'll have to carry over an important piece until Tuesday, but I just might be popping in to see, to be sure that it works. However, we won't be meeting jointly again until Friday, and this may be challenging for the House side, because we have session at noon, and so whether we can actually get here by 1 o'clock may be a little bit up in the air on Fridays. So
good.
We'll see how it goes. With that, I'll close the informational session of the subcommittee on seniors and people with disabilities.
Thank you.